This is an interview with Fred LaBelle for the Mill Workers Oral History Project on January 25th, the year 2006. This is Andrea Lemieux, and we're at the Bates Mill store that is located on... Is
it 2 Cedar Street is the address in the Continental Mill Complex.
And tell me what year you started working in the mills.
At Bates or mills in general?
Mills in general.
Well, my first job is basically in this mill over here. I started working in here in 1952, I believe. And I started to work for my father, who used the maintenance department. From there, I went into the quality control and IE work. And I did take about 6 or 8 months to go to school in Memphis, Tennessee, and learning to class cotton. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated from there, I was a qualified government grader and buyer. But when I came back to work for Bates, I still stayed in the quality control and industrial engineering department. Continental went out of business in 1961. Basically, I was the last person with the mill to get rid of the equipment. And in June of 61, the mill closed, and the week after, I went to work for Bates, also in the industrial engineering department. At that time, Bates had 3 mills. They had the Edwards at Augusta, they had the Hill Division, and Bates in Lewiston. I was stationed at the Androscoggin headquarters. There was a mill on a portion on the side that was set aside for the treasurer and IE department and other mm-hmm. departments. And from there, I would travel the 3 mills, Augusta, or Hill, or Bates. That was 61. In 63, I was assigned in charge of the IE at the Bates division. And I believe in 2 years, I became a general superintendent. And then another 3 or 4 months, I became the manager. So by 1965, I was the manager of the Bates division. I stayed on that job until I don't know how many years, and I became the vice president of manufacturing and eventually president in probably 1988 or 89. Mm-hmm. That's after the Chinese, the Tang brothers, had purchased a mill, I was associated with them. I also forgot to mention, I did leave Bates for 1 year. In 1983, I had a problem with the president at that time, Bill Gleason, and I left to go to work for Guildford up in Guildford, Maine. After a year, John Wall, who was the chairman of the board of Bates, called me and said he wanted to meet with me, and they said that they were not happy what was going on at Bates and if I wanted to come back. Tom Levine came back, and I did to help him. The only reason I came back was because my parents were not feeling that well. And Guildford was so good to me, and I think my parents were okay. I might have stayed at Guildford. Mm-hmm. But in any event, with my parents, I came back. But I was pleased to get back to the operation I knew well. And Tom Levine and I tried to get this place to make it profitable. But there was so much in debt that it was almost impossible. It was just a matter of time that the mill would run out. Now, it's quite a few years. I might be off a year or two. And I believe it was in early 90s or late 80s, the Chinese had stopped. They were not paying their bills and everything else. And the mill was going to close completely. I believe they owed the city $750,000 in back taxes. That's the Chinese. And other bills were mounting all over the place. And they were just stepping out of it. So I approached the city and I say, hey, look, do you want me to continue the operation? I'll do the best I can with it, with limited resources that I have. And they finally agreed, by all means, do it. There's so many people still working. If you can keep it going, we're all for it. So that continued for a couple of years, and we struggled somewhat to keep it going because we just didn't have the backing and the financial to make it worthwhile. So in a couple of years, basically, we did run out of money, and basically we did file for bankruptcy. And one reason we did this is the city at that time had just announced they were going to make a convention center in Mill Number 5, which is most of our operation. So our advisors and legal counsel said, you better go into bankruptcy, because with the money that you owe now, and it's seen coming out in the paper, the banks, I'm sure, were going to force you to pay up. So we figured by filing would give some time that maybe we could recover. That in itself, we didn't. So the mill was out for sale, and I believe it was 19, I'm losing track, in the 90s anyway.
Yeah.
They were sold to, the mill was sold to Faribault Mills, and they had formed American Heritage Brands. Their intent was to have Bates, and they had their own company, was also as old as ours, and they had another elderly mill in the south they were trying to get together. That in itself didn't work out, so basically the mill was closed in 2002 or 2001, and then I started my own operation as a result of this. I just wanted to keep the Bates tradition going, especially on the bedspreads that we were making. They were well known, and I felt if that would stop, that would be the end of it. So I took a gamble and I started a small weaving operation that I have now at the Hill Division. We're struggling, but we're making progress right now. We have 6 looms, and I believe this year will be a good year for us. I'm getting the jacquard hats going the way it should be. So we should be able to produce and deliver to our customers. So actually this was started in, the first loom started in September of 2002, and we've completed 3 years. Now I have 4 jacquard heads going. I have a preparation department to make the warps, and a slasher for loom beams. So pretty independent now. So all we do is buy the yarns, and we're pretty well on our own. We have a small dye house and all, and our product is being well received, and we think this year will be a decent year for us.
Yeah. Is it that it's grown since 2002?
Yes, and it's getting, we had to start from scratch. We had no equipment.
Did you have people that had worked in the mills that you were able to keep?
I was very fortunate to keep some of the technical people that Bates had. Mm-hmm. People like Danny Fitzsimon, who's a tremendous technician on looms and all equipment. I was able to, because my daughter had worked for Bates in the weave room as far as the clerical, and she also was in charge of the cut and sew operation at the end. So she came with me with a couple of the girls that had experience in the cut and sew operation. We also had Ray Billadone, who worked in the dye house, so he came over with us. Dot, an excellent jacquard weaver, also is with us. So right now we have 9 people. In addition to that, we also Leonard for designing and all. And right now he had left last year. He was doing pot work for me, designing, but last year he got a job in Brunswick in one of the industries in there, and I finally convinced him to come back, so he's going to be back with us starting in February. So now I have the people I wanted in place, like Leonard will be designing and other work that I need with Danny and the other, so we'll be about 9 people basically. So I feel this should be a decent year for us.
Now, you talked about the mills declining over the years in terms of production and number of workers, but there also seems to be a continuing interest in this product. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw as some of the reasons for the, was it technology or for the downsizing of the mills or financial?
The downsizing of the mills, to go back, Bates in its heyday had about over 6,000 people when they had 5 mills. In the 50s, the Bates Manufacturing Company was making tremendous amounts of money. I mean, they were very profitable, paying huge dividends to stockholders and everything else. But after the 50s, say late 50s, it started a downhill slide, competition, a little bit from overseas, but the southern mills basically were really hurting Bates to some degree. And Bates had not really kept up with the times to get new equipment to be more efficient. For example, the 50s, when they were making millions of dollars, they could have taken a portion of that and get new equipment. The end results would have been the same, but I think they could have lasted a little longer, because nobody knew of all the imports that's coming in now. most of your mills in the United States now are almost gone, basically. There's a small number of mills that are remaining. If you're in a niche market, which is I am in now, I'm hoping that will keep us going. Most of our competition from Asia, they go more in mass production. They don't want small items. They want volume so they can keep it around the clock 7 days a week. And with their labor, which is only 7 cents an hour, you can't compete with that. They have no environmental problems. They have very, very little insurance and all. So labor-wise, you can't compete with that. But if you have a niche market, and that's my belief, that there's a good possibility we will make it, and especially the product we're doing. It's top quality. It's well received, and I'm proud with our product, and I feel sure that if we service our customers and maintain the quality we have now, we should be fine. Now, I might have forgotten something in regards to, like I said, there were 6,000 people, and then I might add, in the late 50s, I believe, Lester Martin finally took over the company. What I mean by that, he was buying bait stock on the market for years. Well, I wouldn't say for years, but long enough that he got control of it. And his main concern was once he took over this company, there were five mills. The man was brilliant. He knew that buying the company, that what he bought it for, by liquidating the mills, he would make a tremendous amount of money. Because what he paid for it and what he could get for the equipment and the product at that time could be very rewarding. And that's how he started. He closed the one mill they had, the York division in Biddeford. He closed that and sold all the assets. Then he closed the Androscoggin, sold all the assets. His intent was to close Bates, one of the other mills, or the Hill division. At that time, which I believe was in early 60s, he had a heart attack and died. And that's what really preserved the mills, because his intent was to liquidate all the mills. It was very obvious on that. And how I know this, one of my friends used to work for him, and he was telling me on the side, he said, this guy's got plans, and I know what he's going to do. So in a way, the people were fortunate that this happened and kept them going for another 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. But that was the plan. Then his son-in-law took over, and he had good plans. He wanted to build Bates again, and he did purchase other companies to help Bates, but again, it was just too much and too late at the time. Mm-hmm. So eventually, as you know, it eroded with the York going out and the Androscoggin with three mills left, and I believe it was about 3,000 people left at that time. The Hill division, for financial reason, they believe they sold that in 1972. They closed the mill and sold the building, and I believe they did the same with the Edwards. The Edwards was sold to Mr. Miller, Miller Industries. He bought it, and he kept it going for a while until he had a fire. The whole thing went up, and they never started again. And of course, you know about Bates.
Right.
When Bates closed, by the way, I might add, when I took it over, when Tom Levine and I came back, it was about 1,000 people here, and eventually it went down. And I believe when I took over, there's still about 100 some odd people that I tried to maintain, and then eventually went out also.
Now, the looms that you used, were some of those able to be kept from the mills?
The looms that I originally bought were from Biddeford Blanket in Biddeford. Mm-hmm. They were closing, and these looms were available. So I went down and looked at them. They were wide looms and all. And they were used loom, and they were inexpensive, and that's the reason I bought those. Mm-hmm. If I had to buy a dual loom at $30,000 or $40,000, there's no way I could have started. Some of the looms that I bought at Biddeford, I think the first two that I bought were $5,000, which itself was high. Then the next two were at like $2,000, and the last two I bought was $1,000. So that's basically I was able to purchase those because they were very inexpensive at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned your father had worked in the mills.
Yes.
And was he from Lewiston?
My father was from Lewiston, and my grandfather also worked in the mill, but he was from Canada. My grandfather, whose name was Omer, and I still remember him, basically. Now, he worked for this mill, Continental, over here also. Let me go back. My grandfather and two brothers lived, I believe it was Three Pistole in St. Lawrence Seaway. And there was a large family, I believe it was 12 siblings. And I guess food and work was very difficult at the time. They were actually starving, and they heard about the mills. And these were three teenagers, I believe. Well, one was 12, and I believe one 13 and one 15. All three of them decided to go work in the mills. And I understand they took the Grand Trunk Railroad. They came to Lewiston, and they settled over here to go work in the mills. I remember my father telling me about my grandfather. Was his job was he had a team of horses with a wagon, and Continental does not have a railroad siding. So in order for the cart to be received, he had to take his team of horses and a wagon and go to the railroad siding, which is basically by the Hill Division. There used to be tracks in there, and there was an area in there where the cars of cotton would stand there. He'd go in, open the doors by himself, and he would handle those bales, which weighed 500 pounds at a time, all by himself. He'd put it in this wagon. He put six bales at a time with his team of horses, bring them back to Continental, the mill we're in right now, and unload them. And that was his job. That's all he did all his life. And then when my father started in here, he worked in maintenance, basically in the yard. And eventually he became the supervisor. And it's amazing in a way, because my father had very little education. He couldn't write. But he still gave him the job because of his, how shall I say it, perseverance, and he was a hard worker and everything else. He was well-liked.
And what was his name?
Wilfred. Yeah, my grandfather was Omer, and this was Wilfred. And so he worked there all his life. So when the mill closed in 1961, he couldn't believe it. I believe he had worked here about 40 years then. And he was still, I think he was about 60 years old in that area. And then he went to work for Bob Roy. And Bob Roy knew my father, knew the type of worker he was, so he gave him a job. And my dad worked until he retired in 68. Then he had lung cancer and he died. I believe he was 81 years old. Mm-hmm. And my mother worked in the mill.
Your mother did as
my
well.
My mother also was a doffer, and my grandmother was also a spinner doffer. So the family itself, most of our people worked in the mill. What I remember, it stands out as far as my grandmother and my mother. My grandmother worked at the Hill Division as a doffer spinner.
What is that?
They have spinning frame, they have bobbins. And when yarn is processed from roving, it makes yarn and small bobbins, and they got to come off the frame. So what they do when they're filled up, the frame stops, and they have to take the bobbins out, the full ones, and put empty ones. And work was very difficult in those days. People were waiting in line for work. But the people who worked in the mill were pretty clever in a way. What they were doing is, like, my grandmother was on the first shift, I don't know how many hours, maybe 11 hours a day. So my mother would bring her a lunch. Maybe she was 9 or 10 years old, bring her a lunch at noon. And while my grandmother was eating her lunch, my mother would start working to learn the job. So that's how they learned with their mother or whatever it was. So after doing that for maybe a year or so, and again, my mother, maybe only 12 or 13, she went to work in the mills. When there was an opening, she went in, they say, you have experience? Oh, yes, I've been doing. Then she would show them what she could do, and she was hired. So my mother, again, all her life spent in the mill as a spinner doffer. And when the Hill, I believe, closed in 72, then she came to work at the Bates Division in the finishing room. And she was a mender. She stayed there until she was 65 or 66, then she retired. She just passed away about 4 years ago at 91 or 92 years old. Hmm.
Yeah. And when you were thinking about going into the mills, what age were you?
When I started, I came back. I attended Bates for a couple of years. Then I went to the service. I went to OCS in Fort Benning, Georgia. I had a bad knee, so I got banged up in the service, so I came out of the service. But while I was in the service, I got married to my wife, Theresa. And so when I came back, I didn't go back to school. I came back to work at Continental for my father, so I thought maybe I'll go to school after, but I never did.
So was your father working in the mill a help to you getting the job? Was it hard to get into the mill in your generation? Or
I don't remember. I don't think it was that hard. Well, at the time, yeah, I did have a chance because I knew my dad, and he would hire me. And I used to do it in the summers while I was going to school. And as far as the age, I believe I was 22 when I came to work in the mills when I started. So, and from him, like I said, I worked there and I learned cotton classing. In all your mills, you used to have what they called a cotton classer, a cotton buyer. All the yarn, or not the yarn, but all the fiber that comes to a mill, people probably think, well, a bale of cotton is a bale of cotton. Well, they're all different. They have different lengths of staple. It goes anywhere from 13/16 of an inch to an inch and a quarter. The longer the fiber, the more expensive it is. You have about six or seven different colors of cotton. You got white, you got stain, you got tinge, you and grays and all. And these all have value. And when you make fabric, you got to make sure you have the right staple, you have the right color. And what I mean by preparation, that it's nice and smooth. You got micronair, you got to be. So I was learning this with a Dom and Fisk. It used to be the cotton class over here. And while I was working with my dad, every time he needed me, he'd call me and I'd go help him. And I'd start to learn how to do cotton classing. And after a while, he was letting me do a lot of his work. He used to play golf at Martindale. And one afternoon, I don't remember what age I was, but he went to play golf, and going up the first hill, he had a heart attack and died. The mill agent at the time, Vernon Faulkner, who was part owner and all, knew that I did some work with Norm and Fisk, and he called me in. He said, Fred, he said, I know you work with Norm. Can you take this over? I was scared. I didn't know at the time, and I said, I don't believe I can do this to that extent. He said, well, I appreciate your honesty, and so I'll get. So they hired somebody from Rhode Island. And when this individual came in and he started doing the cotton classing, he started getting me working with him. And I realized that I was more capable than he was. So I said, wow. But I had to admit, I didn't have the experience anyway. So at that time, I made up my mind and I said, I'm going to go to school to learn this if this comes up again. Yes. What I was saying is, I said, when I saw this, then I said, I do the school in Memphis. It was the Murdoch Scott Classic and Buying School. And I said, I'm going to go there. I had just been married. And I told my wife, and she thought it was a good idea. So I told the company that I needed some time off, that I would go there. And I was hoping that they might be. And they couldn't at the time. They said, no, we can't help you with that at all. So I said, well, okay, I'm going down. So I did sign up for school. I went in. I drove down to Memphis. And I did the school. I did everything that was expected of me. It was like an international school. You had people from all over the world learning this trade. The fact that I had experience before, when I finished that school, I was qualified and I had a license to be a government classer. In other words, I could go work for the government. I don't know what E grade or whatever it was, mm-hmm. but it was fairly good money at the time. And the fact, like I said, I worked with Bates before, and I like with going to school gave me 5 years of experience. And then I did have a government license, but I never took it. I just came back, and I came back to my job over here, and they were pleased to get me back. And I said, well, if it happens again, I'll be ready. But in the meantime, a year or two later, something happened, and I went into the industrial engineering department and quality control. And eventually, another year, I was running it over here. I was in charge of those two departments until the mill closed, like I said, in 1961.
What was your job in that position?
I was in charge of quality control and industrial time study work, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I had about three people in here that were working for me. There was about one other person to quality control, which is doing checks in the mill, checking yarns, making sure the quality of weights of sheeting. Continental here was known for very high quality sheeting. They used to do government work in parachute cloth, handkerchiefs. It was a well-known mill as far as quality, and this competed with the Hill Division. Basically, the products are basically the same. But at the bottom, and for the time study, was doing engineering work for job evaluation, time study work, one of the supposedly like efficiency experts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's a job. And when I left this mill to go to Bates, that's what I stayed in, basically, in quality control. Not really quality control, but the time study work there.
Yeah. And you said that, especially in the early days when your grandparents were working in the mills, it was very hard work. It's very manual labor. How did that change over the years that you saw in terms of dangers to injuries?
As far as the mills, I can go back from the experience of what I heard from people. When the Bates first started, I'm going back like the 1850s or 60s or 70s. Remember, there was no electricity. Everything was water power. In other words, the hydros and all, and the by shafts and belts, this is how the equipment used to run. And what was dangerous then is like a girl like you with hair like you have there, the chances are, if that wasn't tied down, you could be scalped because the belts going by, if your hair got caught in there, and that happened. And it was very dangerous in that respect. But after electricity came in and they got rid of the belts and better equipment, it was just more efficient. People still worked fairly hard, only the hours got shorter. In the early 1900s, we were working 54 and 56 hours a week. I believe it was 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, and 6 hours on Saturday. That was that week, 56 hours, basically. Then I know 1912, like in Lawrence, the state made a new law to cut it down to 54 hours from 56, but the people felt they'd get paid for it. They didn't. That was a major strike. That was a real problem then in the 1912s. But the hours got shorter, as you know, and eventually went down to 40 hours. But exactly over the years how it broke down is all I know. At first it was in the 60s and eventually down to the 40s. Yeah. That's what made it much better for the people to work in here. And keep in mind, the mills too were a three-day operation. In other words, they had people in the first shift, second shift, and third shift. It was 24 hours straight, simply because the equipment's so expensive. If you bought equipment, you didn't want to run just one shift. You're running three shifts, so you want to utilize the equipment as much as you can. Now, the mills in the Sound, they used to work 6 days a week around the clock. They had an advantage. They didn't work. I don't think they paid overtime on Saturdays for a while until the federal laws got into effect. But they used to work 6 days a week. Now, as far as the hardness, people still work fairly hard. And of course, being in the industrial engineering department, people were allowed 15% of their time for personal. In other words, in a day, they were allowed 72 minutes to take breaks, to have lunch, go to the restroom and all. And that was pretty standard. You set up workloads for people to work, for most of the time, except for that 72 minutes. And we took studies. In our department at Bates, we had, I believe it was 11 or 12 people working in there to do time study work and all the three mills at that time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is how you try to keep your labor costs in line. So you wouldn't want somebody working in a department working 7 hours a day and having the 72, and then have somebody else only working 4 hours, and that created a problem, plus the fact your costs would be too high. So our job was to make sure everybody worked and make sure that it was not overworking also. And so we constantly took time studies, and that's what we tried to do. All set, Leonard? Yeah. All right, take care.
And what is your date of birth?
March 5th, 29.
So you grew up late in Lewiston, late 30s into the 40s, where you can remember?
My home is right across the street here.
Is it?
On Cedar Street, uh-huh. Which is part of Little Canada, basically. So, as a matter of fact, when I worked at Bates, when we got married, my father owned the apartment house, and I used to live on the first floor, and all I had to do was go across the street to work. So it was convenient. Then in 1963, I bought some land on Randall Road, and I built my house, which I am today.
What was Little Canada like and the larger Lewiston community like when you were growing up?
I would say Canada was a very close-knit group. I mean, we never locked our doors, everybody's friendly, you don't have the problem that you have today and all over the United States. I mean, right now, if you don't lock your doors, you're going to lose something. Somebody's going to come in. But people were, as I said, very friendly. Hardly the problem. Well, you still have a few people breaking a few windows here and there while they were playing around. But most of the cases, it was pretty quiet, pretty friendly, and everybody seemed to get along fairly well. Mm.
And what did you and your parents do for social activities? Was it centered around the church or the people you worked with in the mill, or a combination?
A combination, basically. Because yeah. St. Mary's is right across the street from us, the church, and that's what we used to attend. And my parents basically both working. They'd come home at night and rest, basically. And my grandmother at the time was... They were taking care of her also. But I remember them just going to work, coming home, and they'd go out for a ride or eat out once in a while. But most of the time, they'd stay home. And of course, then you got television in the 50s, and that was their new hobby. They got a TV set and watched that all the time.
Well, were they both on the same shift at the mill?
Not at first, because I remember my mother saying she was working, I believe it was the second shift, and she'd come out at night to make sure that I was fed and everything else. My dad was on the first, she was on the second shift a number of years. Mm-hmm. Then eventually she was on the first shift also.
And were you an only child?
Yes. Or? Yes.
And so your grandmother grew up in the household with you for some years, or was that later years?
That was later years. Well, I remember, well, maybe I was 10 or 12, that she was living with my parents right here on Cedar Street. They bought a house, I believe it's 51 on Stewart Street, and that's when they moved out of here. And that's when I took it over. I mean, basically, I just got married, and they said, well, don't you take this apartment house, you're working over here, or somewhat. Yeah. And in the early 50s, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm.
And did they speak French in the home?
Most of the time. They spoke very little English. My father did enough to get by. That's why he became the supervisor. And my mother could speak a little bit. But I would say 95% of the time, they would speak French. Mm-hmm. French-Canadian. Yeah.
So that was probably your first language
it
when
was.
You went to school. You had to learn English?
I was at St. Mary's. As a matter of fact, in the fourth grade, my brother wanted me to learn English. So she transferred me over to Coburn School at the time. It was a public school. Mm. And from Coburn went to Jordan and Lewiston High. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of economically, Lewiston was a pretty vibrant shopping center at the time you were growing up. Is that what you recall? Mm. Or maybe not?
Not really, to be honest
okay.
with you. You know, you're growing up, and I don't think I observed that at all as far as the shopping centers and everything else. I knew they were there, to what extent, how it compared to other places, I really didn't watch that too closely.
What are some of the experiences that you had working in the mill that stick out in your mind over the years?
Well, some of the management people and top, of course, when I became a VP or a plant manager, I used to travel to New York, and I didn't notice a lot of activities were going on, and I didn't think were too bright, if I may say so. Because some of the top management would spend money foolishly in New York. There was one individual, I won't mention his name, but he had an office, and it was ridiculous the amount of money he would spend on that with plush carpeting and walls and thousands of dollars, and I knew at the mills that people were just struggling to get by, and I thought it was a lot of waste of money up in the top management in New York. But most people were fairly good, but those few individuals, basically. Now, one thing that still stands in mind, Bates, after Arnold Ginsberg took over, decided to get into the production of polyester fibers. And he hired this man to build a plant in Virginia, I believe. I think today it's Phillips, but it was a small operation at the time. He built a fiber plant producing. And I remember after a couple of years when it was ready to go, they had an opening day. This gentleman that was instrumental in building this plant invited everybody, and I know Arnold Ginsberg, who was the president, owned the whole thing, was went over, And I remember somebody asking this guy that was in charge, the whole plan was asked, are you going to be there? He said, no. He said, that damn thing might blow up. He said, I'm not going to be over there. And he wasn't. He never showed up on it, but it did start at all. But it was a very small operation, so it never did compete. But it did sell it to somebody else who got involved. Phillips, who I believe, ended up buying it. And Arnold Ginsberg also had bought Virginia Iron and Coal. And these were coal fields in Virginia and West Virginia. And I know he bought that fairly well as far as money. And I believe three individuals came in when Mr. Ginsberg needed money to keep this operation going. We got some people in from New York for investments. And these three people came in, and I remember lending Arnold $8 million when I came out in public to keep the mills going, and they would, you know, take some responsibility in the mills. But after 3 or 4 years, they more or less took control of it, and they bought Arnold out. He went out with another company, and they took it over. And I remember it was just around the energy crisis, so those coal lands, 1976, I believe, the amounts of monies that they made as a result of that, for a small investment of $8 million, they got coal land and all that was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So they did very well. They were sharp businessmen at the time. That's one of the things. In the mill itself, I remember one of the individuals in the dye house, a very friendly individual, you talked to him, and very well popular with the people. I know one Monday morning we came in and he worked at dye house, and undoubtedly he had some problem because he hung himself in the mill. He was right there. So we had a few people, like one that took his life this way. Well, we had a few accidents and probably people got hurt, and these are things you remember. But one good thing is most of the people were very cooperative and worked very well. Lucille Blay used to be the union president, and she worked in the cut and sew operation. Very good person to work with. She was a fair person. She represented the union, but she was also very fair to both ways, the mill and the people. And she, I believe she got a daughter through college, through the mill, and many times she'd mention how good the mill was to her and provided a livelihood for her family and all. And with quite a few people like that. I mean, these people now worked here for like 30, 40, 50 years, so.
Right.
And Lucille was probably one of the best stitches the mill had. So she earned her money because she was a fast and hard worker. She did very well.
You mentioned the unions, and that brings to mind Denny Blay, who was the New England agent for the textile workers.
Yes.
In your position, did you have interactions with him?
Yes, I knew him. I had meetings with him. I knew him personally. And I would say Denny Blay was one of the smartest person I ever met. You could go to, every so often you'd have arbitration or something, or things that management and you would not agree. And if you went to an arbitration and Denny was the arbitrator for the union, his record was very good. And what was amazing with Denny Blay was, you could go to an arbitration meeting that might last for 2 hours. He had no notes. Everything was in his head. I mean, he was a brilliant man as far as I'm concerned. I remember speaking for hours without looking at notes and all. And he was excellent. I always wanted to be on his side because he was so good.
And talk about, if you can, some of the social activities that were connected with the mills. I know there was, I don't know if you were involved personally, but like the baseball team.
You had baseball, you had softball, you had bowling. And also Bates, every so often would rent the rink and have skating parties for the employees. Now in 1950, which by the way is before my time, I wasn't here then, was at the 100-year celebration. And then the, what's his name? I'm trying to think of the Maurice Chevalier.
Mm-hmm.
He was hired, or they've got him to come to Lewis and his entourage to sing at the Lewis and Armory, and all the employees were there. So Bates went out to help to some degree. And they used to have a meeting, which I was involved a few times with the employees when it was 20. Every year they had 25-year employees. Well, you can imagine they have 2,000 or 3,000 people that every year they'd have a number of people that would have 25 years. They would go to the Poland Spring House. That used to be, I don't know if you're familiar mm-hmm. with that. Okay. Mm-hmm. That was every year they used to do that. They'd go to Poland Spring, and all the people at 25 years or more were all invited. So it was all a gathering every summer that they would hire the hall at Poland Spring. That was a fact that was done every year. Hmm. And of course, when the mill started closing, that backed off a little bit. But it's heyday when Bates was doing very well. That was very common for them to do.
Were you involved in any of the bowling or baseball?
Yeah, I was involved with the baseball, basically, to some degree, and in bowling. I used to be a part of it. I joined one of the leagues to be with them to some degree. Mm-hmm.
And over the years, you've probably seen a few strikes at the mill.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? What the ones you remember and what... why they occurred and what the resolution was?
I'm trying to think. I believe it was probably late 1970s. And I believe people wanted to strike because they wanted, I believe it was a money issue, mm-hmm. trying to get additional monies. And I remember that I was in the mill with Woody Lambert, who was president at the time. And the union had said that if we don't have an answer by a certain time, we are striking. And I remember at 11 o'clock, I don't remember if it was a Friday or Thursday or whatever, and when it came to that time, the people walked out of the mill. We were still in the mill at that time. So it was expected that they would walk out. But within a few days after, it was settled. That's one that I do remember. Yeah. I know I've gone through like 3 or 4 of those so over the years, but... there was one way back too, I believe. We were out for 3 or 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I believe that might have been in the 60s, but at that time. But most of them would resolve it, you know, either a few days or a week or two. Mm-hmm. But the longest one I remember, I think, was 3 weeks on that.
Do you recall Hal Goslin?
Hal Goslin, yes.
What was his role at the mill?
Hal was assistant to the president. And as a matter of fact, if I have to give him credit for getting my job as the plant manager, because he recommended me to Frank Cheatham, who was like a president at that time mm-hmm. for that job. Hal was a very knowledgeable man, like Denny Blay, who was very sharp in too. Denny was on one side, Hal was on the other side. Hal was smart and worked awfully hard. And his office basically was where, if you're familiar with Bates, where Turgeon, Al Turgeon is right now, in the executive office. That was his office basically. And Hal did a lot of traveling. You go to New York and represent the president. And if the president came, which was Arnold Ginsburg, Al would take care of him basically. Hal did all the public relations in this area and did an excellent job with that. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think I'm missing in terms of your memories?
Well, the only thing is basically, I might add, is of course Bates in 1976 became a NESOT company, Employee Stock Ownership Trust. That's when the, again, they had run out of money. And they, again, those three individuals that took over the company for $8 million and got all this land and all the money they made. I think his name... Well, one of the individuals was very familiar with ESOTs, and he knew someone on the West Coast in regard to establishing an ESOT. So he worked at that, and he was finally able to convince that was the way to go. I think at that time, in the late... I'm trying to think, late 70s, or 76 if I remember correctly, he was not happy with the result. He had taken over the Bates Mill and he had all this money invested, and making 1% or 2% was not enough for him. He was a real financial man. His intent was to make money. He didn't care people or what. I have money invested, I want a return or else. And I think at that time, I think he had three options. One was if I can sell the mill to somebody else, that's probably the one of the best things to do, that I could, you know, recoup all this money and all. And another one was, if I don't, I'm just going to liquidate it and take whatever I could get for the equipment and bail out. And the other one that came out was this ESOT, that I probably could have the employees take over the mill. And I believe it was for $7 million at the time, $7 or $8 million. They worked with the Farmers Home lend the money to the employees, and the Bank of Boston was involved with it. And I believe he got $8 million for that transfer at the time, but the employees would take over.
Two, three. We are now on side B. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No problem. And the debt, I mean, Bates still owed like $12 billion on the books. So besides borrowing $8 million, I believe they still had $12 million of debt that they had to take care of. And in the late 70s, if I remember correctly, that's when the interest rates started to go ridiculously high, and I think it went up to 18% or 19%. So not only did we have to pay X number of dollars per month through the Bank of Boston, but all the interest made it impossible to make any money. It's a matter of fact, the first month we were on our own, we were in violation of the agreement we had at the bank. We were not able to maintain anything. So that's one of the reasons that Bates was never able to make it, because they were in a deep hole, they just couldn't get out of it. Not that it would have made any difference. Sooner or later would have gone out anyway with the way the activity is today. Mm. But this employee stock ownership, the people had a real interest in that, because they felt that, wow, we got a chance of making some money in there. And if I remember correctly, I think the shares of stock on this ESOT at one time went up to either $1.50 or $2.50. So people felt great about that. Wow, $2.50 a share. But then it started going the other way, and there was pennies, and then hardly anything. And of course, when the plant closed, it was nothing. We still have people calling today that one of used to work here passed away, and they must see the shares of stock. They'll call, what is this worth? And it's unfortunate, you have to tell them it's worth nothing. Or they had life insurance that when the mills closed, that it became worthless. I think I had 2 weeks ago somebody called me, somebody worked, and said, "Oh, I noticed an insurance." I said, "Unfortunately, when Bates went out, these were worthless, basically." That's one thing I remember. And Bates had companies, so they had a small plant in Canada too, basically, that they had set up, and they were trying to circumvent, I guess, the taxes on cotton. They would go up to Canada, they'd process it, they would bring it back to the States and save all kinds of money. But by the time they got it going, the government stopped it. And actually, it was in Waterloo, and that's what it was a waste of money up there. Mm-hmm. So a lot of money was wasted, basically. And of course, the other thing, Bates manufactured at one time owned all the water rights. And that's, unfortunately, when they sold it, they lost all this potential money they could have had. Again, it's when they had a shortage of cash, they sold it to, I believe it was the lowest in the community, it was the city that bought it over, and then they turned around and sold right back to Central Maine Power. Bates at one time, I don't know how many kilowatt of power they had, but they had three wheels at Bates, four or six wheels at Hill, and a couple of wheels at Androscoggin. Mm-hmm. And that was a real money maker, but unfortunately they sold it before the full value was in effect. So Central Maine Power now has got all of those. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you so much.
Over the years, I'm sure I've forgotten a lot, but as you get older, you do forget a lot.
Well, you remembered a lot today, so thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.